who was in the McIntyre Institute of Art, I think, at the University of Virginia, one of my favourite places, and who's going to speak to us today on the Bhagavata Purana and a persistence of vision.
Thank you, thank you. And I'd like to thank you all for having me here as the Khaitan Fellow. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's great fun, and it's such a lovely place with such a good atmosphere. I'm very happy. And I know that everyone here works to make that good atmosphere, so I want to express my gratitude. All right. I've been thinking, obviously, I've been thinking for many years about Bhagavad illustration. And those of you who know me and know what I've worked on will know that my talk today, when you finally heard it, is a combination of old and new thoughts, but they're so organically intertwined that I feel I can't present what I've been thinking about more recently without reiterating at least some of the old thoughts that I have. So I ask your indulgence, particularly of Andrew and Nirja, because they're going to be hearing some things that will be familiar to them. It's a truism the great works of Indian literature and religion are composed rather than written, that they exist primarily in recitation, and that the written versions are simply ways to preserve a text that must be spoken to live. This fact is reflected in manuscript illustrations that show the recitation of the text, such as a folio here from an early 17th century Mewar Bhagavata Purana, showing Shuka reciting the story of the abduction of Rukmini to King Parikshit. Another is from a 16th century Chandayana, divided at partition between Pakistan, technically the Lahore Museum, though many folios of it are in Karachi, in the National Museum of Pakistan, and India. The Indian folios are in Chandigarh, that show Mulla Daud reciting the text that relates to the illustration. Both of these texts are religious, but even in texts that are not explicitly religious, such as the famous illustrated 16th century Charapanchashaka that was in the collection of N.C. Mehta and is now in the Gujarat Museum Society in Ahmedabad, the poet Bilhana, and there's supposed to be a leaf from the Bhagavat, from the Charapanchashaka up right now, frequently appears as both poet and participant. This is an important dimension of the relationship of illustration, not only to text, but to a tradition of recitation, a tradition of performance of text, so essential to the South Asian literary tradition. And when one thinks of recitation of texts, one that comes immediately to mind is, of course, the Bhagavata Purana, the fifth Veda of the Vallabhites. Of the 12 books of the text, by far the most frequently illustrated is the 10th book that narrates the life of Krishna. And we see here the slaying of Aghasur, and you have that lovely, large Orison one on the stairway, so it's the same story. The earliest surviving illustrated version of the 10th book is a dispersed series of illustrations with full text that originally was intended to have some 360 illustrations. It's not entirely clear that it was ever completed, but I've come to think it probably was. It is undated, and no place of production is given, but it can be dated on grounds of style to about 1520 to 1530. And in my view, it was probably produced in the Delhi-Agra region, perhaps in Mathura, though I think Andrew might disagree with me on that. We've had discussions about this in the past, and and either one of us could be right, or we could both be wrong. The entire Sanskrit text was illustrated. It appears on the reverse of the leaves in quite a clear hand, as you see here, and there are vernacular captions on many of them, in a variety of hands. The leaves are thoroughly scattered throughout the world. Indeed, since the fact of its thorough dispersal is so significant, we may call it the dispersed Bhagavata Purana. And many leaves are lost, but enough survive to document an interesting visual trope. While the set has the usual illustration of the recitation of the text by Shuka, and you see it here, it's in the Sarabhai Foundation in Ahmedabad, many illustrations contain representations of characters within the story, seemingly narrating what is going on in the illustration and, of course, in the text. Note, for example, in the leaf illustrating Krishna stealing curd, which is in the Bharat Kala Bhavan in Benares, that a gopi narrates to Yashoda the events taking place in the illustration, where Krishna, shown twice in continuous narration, steals curd and distributes it to monkeys and cowherd boys, including his brother Balaram. This narrative of the story, this sort of implied narration of the story, is in part simply textual. The gopi comes to complain of Krishna's naughty behavior. But so ubiquitous is the visual device of an implied narrative in the illustrations that it frequently appears in illustrations without specific textual passages that describe the recounting of the story. For example, in the illustration of Krishna aiding Bhima in the slaying of Jarasandha from the 72nd adhyaya of the 10th book, which also utilizes continuous narration, in the upper left are two women in a pavilion, I think one can say clearly discussing the events narrated in the text, as Krishna tears a straw in two to demonstrate to Bhima how to slay the wicked king. Such images are found over and over again in these Bhagavata illustrations. They have gone unremarked in scholarly literature, including my own, but they've increasingly nagged at me over the years. They're certainly not references to the recitation of the text by Shuka, and are likewise not references to the ritual recitation of the text as described in the Bhagavata Mahatmya. The figures are ordinary men and women, not Brahmin practitioners. And yet, they clearly refer to recitation and narration, perhaps to performance of the text. They must mean something, but what do they mean? To think about this question, it's useful to consider more broadly the matter of the representation of Krishna in the 16th century, the vitality of the Krishnite revival under Vallabha and his followers and contemporaries underlies the production of illustrated series such as the dispersed Bhagavata Purana, as well as the many other illustrated 16th century versions of the life of Krishna that followed, the beginnings of a whole series of illustrated manuscripts and sets in subsequent centuries. A notable feature of the illustrations of the dispersed Bhagavata Purana is their vibrant and inventive compositions. There has been a long tradition of representation of the Krishna story in sculpture, dating from at least the Gupta period. And here you see the temple at Devgar, the 5th century temple at Devgar. Many people date it later, but they're entitled to be wrong. It's 5th century. And on the plinth of the Devgar temple, and I'll show you a photograph of it before the recent restoration, which I put in quotes, of the of superstructure, which I find a little confusing and problematic, but I haven't really made a clear study of it. And as you can see, the pre-restoration phase, it's also confusing, but we do know it had a superstructure, which is one of the reasons it ended up getting dated later. But on the plinth around the temple, and we can't be sure that the existing panels are exactly where they were originally, but we know that they were on the plinth. There's a whole series of panels illustrating the story of Krishna and illustrating the Ramayana, which is something else I've thought about and can talk about at some length. And here you see a representation. Most of the panels have been removed to the National Museum in Delhi or are in the sculpture shed, which unfortunately was unavailable when I was at Devgarh. But this one is still more or less in its original placement, and you get some sense of the kind of illustration that's typical. With few exceptions, the compositions tend to be quite simple, as you see here, monoscenic. Unlike the action-filled, continuous narratives of the early Bhagavad, the first, as I've said before, illustrations of the text according to the 10th book that survive. And other roughly contemporary series of illustrations in the same style as the dispersed Bhagavata Purana, such as the Charupanchashaka, exhibit compositions that are elegant and formal, and I'm really sorry that somehow I dropped that CPS illustration out, but show little of the liveliness of the Bhagavata. Where does the inspiration for these lively illustrations come from? One place to look is the Kumbhashyama temple in Chittor, an 8th century temple that was restored in the 15th century, where there is a carved panel from the 15th century, which you see on your right. It's in the mandapa as you enter, it's on your right, illustrating the story of Krishna. And this panel breaks the rather simple compositional conventions that are so typical in carved representations of the Krishna story in new ways. Here you see a larger version starting up here with the birth, the exchange of babes, and it's a bit hard to read, but I have some details that might make it a little clearer. You see here the sleeping guards. And this, by the way, is a composition that one can find exactly in 16th century painting. The exchange, here, we see the slaying of Putana. This is probably the wind demon. Here we see the cart demon. These are all in this section of the panel. And this interesting device, the subjugation of Kaliya, but the sculptor has used the river as a kind of unifying device, so that we have, although one can argue that this is broken up into panels, there's a kind of sense of an interrelationship of these different different episodes, which is quite unusual for the in the long history of representations of the life of Krishna in stone. But this is just a tiny bit of evidence for what is really in the 16th century a significant compositional transformation. To help understand this situation further, we can turn to what is perhaps an unlikely place, Mughal painting in the reign of Akbar. The great Persian Razumnama, a translation of the Mahabharata, was prepared for Akbar between 1582 and 1584. About that time, the Imperial Mughal Workshop began a splendidly illustrated version of the text, a project completed about 1586. The manuscript, now in the Jaipur City Palace Museum and unavailable to scholars for many years, contains as an appendix a version of the Harivansha. Another manuscript, apparently of the Harivansha alone, was completed about 1590, and you see a page of that here from the Binney collection, now in the San Diego Museum of Art. The text portion of this manuscript, along with six of the original illustrations, is preserved in the State Museum in Lucknow. Several illustrations have been removed, some probably as early, including this one is the 18th century. This is in an 18th century margin, of just a tiny bit of which you can see up here. But if you look at the website in San Diego, you can see the whole margin. Several illustrations are lost, the rest dispersed among public and private collections all over the world. Both the Rasamnama and the Harivansha, of course, include numerous illustrations of episodes from Krishna's life. Robert Skelton points out, in his highly informative article on the six Harivansha leaves now in the Victorian Albert Museum in London, that one of the main points of interest of these manuscripts, the Harivansha and the Jaipur Rasamnama, is their vivid compositions. In his 1970 article, he suggests that the articles were, and I quote, perhaps recreating the visions which had filled their minds in childhood during the spoken and acted reiteration of the stories. Now, the visions that Skelton so vividly evokes are continuations and elaborations of the visual vocabulary of the Krishna story, common for centuries to the peoples of India. An examination of Rasamnama and Harivansha illustrations in relation to those of the same incidents from the dispersed Bhagavata Purana reveals their common heritage and serves to illuminate further our understanding of the complex relationship between pre-Akbar and Akbar period compositions. And here you see the attack on a Pragjyotishapura, the citadel of Nataka. Here in the early example, and this, by the way, is also in the Binny collection, so it's, they have a kind of a built-in, very nice comparison right there in San Diego. Although when one looks at these, one sees immediately, one thinks, these are very different stylistically, of course. Here we have the flat, abstract, brightly colored style that is the dominant style in North India in the first half of the 16th century, and versions of which continue to be extremely important well into the 17th century and even beyond. Whereas the Mughal example is three-dimensional, has a much more controlled and refined palette, is a quite different representation. But if one looks underneath these stylistic differences and thinks about the underlying compositional devices, we see interesting parallels. Krishna relates to his victim, the Nataka, who's about to get it here, in a rather vigorous diagonal, which is further emphasized by the canonry, which of course is not mentioned in the Bhagavat text, something that was added by this artist. And here we have Krishna coming in, sort of flying wedge. Here the Mughal artist has conflated his arrival with the attack on Nataka. He's thrown his disc, his chakra has sliced the demon. And this I know from experience, having had this picture in an exhibition, extremely popular with fourth grade boys. They like a picture like this. Wanted to look at it a lot. And we're also actually interested in talking about its composition, amazingly enough. Children can be astonishing sometimes when they're in front of works of art. You also see the strong emphasis, the use of the head in profile, which is the preferred representation of the human form in traditional South Asian painting. These rather square-headed figures, particularly evident in this representation of Satyabhama, who comes in. And interestingly enough, this sort of circular moat is echoed in the more or less circular handling of the walls of the Palace of Nataka. So one can think of an illustration like this as representing compositional elements that can be turned into a schema that were then turned into a kind of more fully three-dimensional view in the Mughal style, in keeping with what Pramod Chandra has called the Mughal vision of naturalism. What Kumaraswamy somewhat disparagingly said was a painting that was intent upon the current moment. And so you see here, there's a kind of timeless quality to this rather more abstracted composition, whereas here we're kind of drawn into the immediacy of the action. But there are these interesting compositional parallels. Likewise, in the battle with Bana, this is also in the Bharat Kalabhavan, and here's a page from the Jaipur manuscript, in black and white, because that's all we have access to. You can see that the Mughal composition has arranged the combatants in two lines facing each other, just has been done in the early dispersed Bhagavat composition, so that we have an exact transference into a more fully realized three-dimensional form of this compositional device of showing the two armies in opposition to each other. And notice also, let me just go back for a moment, here again, this sort of discussion going on, and here. And to go back to our representation of the slaying of Jarasandh, although the Jaipur example is quite different, notice that the relationship of Krishna to Bhima and his victim are echoed in the early example, and this is divided into two registers. Again, we have continuous narration. Here Krishna is congratulating Bhima, and here we see the Jarasandha split asunder. But notice that this too is divided into registers. And the color change is precisely at the point, is precisely parallel to the lower register of the early dispersed Bhagavat example. This is, again, very flat, very schematic, and this is more fully realized in the Mughal three-dimensional manner. But interesting that there's the preservation of that division of a composition like this into two registers. This page, by the way, having been on the London Art Market many years ago and having gone into a private collection in the United States, is now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And just bring your attention again back to these women chatting here in the upper left-hand corner. Skelton's suggestion of spoken, and let me emphasize, acted reiteration of the stories in relation to the Mughal compositions, I think, can be equally applied to the earlier Bhagavata Purana illustrations. Now, this is where I move away a bit from the objects themselves and get a little speculative. Though performance is by nature evanescent, And until modern recording techniques, there was no way to preserve even a shadow of any performance. We know from the literary record that there is a history of performance of the Krishna story dating back at least to the early 16th century, and surviving, of course, into modern times. In his essay, "Did Sur Das Perform the Bhagavata Purana?", Jack Hawley briefly refers to performances whose evidence is preserved in literary texts. And though he mostly discusses the recitation of the Bhagavata Purana text, or vernacular renditions of the stories, he gives clear references to enacted renditions, citing 16th century figures who both approve of them, Malik Muhammad Jayasi, who thought they were a very good thing indeed and should be encouraged, and disapprove of them. And that was Guru Nanak, who thought they were vulgar expressions. And Hawley here is also citing Norvin Hines' 1972 book, The Miracle Plays of Mathura. To recapitulate, at a time of great revival in the worship of Krishna, centered in Braj, but felt widely throughout India, we know that there were performances of the life of Krishna. At the same time exactly, there emerges an illustrated version of the life of Krishna, and as I have said twice already, and what I tell you three times is true, the earliest surviving series of such illustrations, possibly painted in Braj itself, that's what I believe, that has within it frequent references to recitation and perhaps performances of stories, such as you see here. These are not directly connected to representations of the quote-unquote original recitation by Shuka, nor to ritual recitation as described in the Bhagavata Mahatmya. Might we speculate, then, that the suddenly vital and unusually lively illustrations of the dispersed Bhagavata Purana reflect, however imperfectly, a popular tradition of performance of the Krishna story, Skelton's acted reiteration of the beloved tales of the cowherd god? We can, of course, never know for certain, barring the discovery of evidence which is unlikely to be waiting for us. The performances are long gone, only shadows preserved imperfectly that remain in two brief mentions from contemporary texts and in traditions that survived into modern times, though undoubtedly with profound changes. I think one can say that at the very least they suggest a tradition of recitation that we might posit is not necessarily in Sanskrit, a supposition I think that's bolstered by the Braj captions that appear on many of the leaves, including this one. And what of these innovative compositions? Once developed, here just to emphasize that sort of internal representation of storytelling, once developed, they survive in surprisingly consistent and sometimes altered forms in countless examples spread throughout North, and I'm beginning to think, South Indian painting styles over the subsequent centuries. And you have here an example of the attack on the citadel of Nautica from 1688, illustrated manuscript of the Bhagavata Purana that Anirja has done a great deal of excellent work on. And you can see that the compositional type is preserved to a considerable degree, including even the canonry that we don't find in the Sanskrit text. This 1688 manuscript, part of a double manuscript, the 1686 portion of which is dispersed, the 1688 portion of it is in the Kanoria collection in Patna, and it was the subject of an excellent dissertation by Nirja Poddar, who is here to my left. And you see, I'm doing that so as not to get any public criticism from Nirja from my talk. And so we see the compositional type surviving well into up to the end of the 17th century. And one sees interesting ways that these devices continue to be used well into the 18th century. This is an example on the right. An example on the left is, of course, from the dispersed Bhagavat. You can probably recognize that now. And an example on the right from a Basholi series illustrating the Bhagavat that's in the Binny collection. This particular leaf is not in the Binny collection. I'm sorry. This one was in the Ehrenfeld collection, and its present location is unknown to me. If you know Nirja, or if you know Andrew, let me know. I'm curious to know where it is. But in the Binny collection, there is a page from the same series, though it does not have a colophon, that, if it ever existed, is lost. There's a page in the Binny collection in the San Diego Museum of Art that bears a date of 1769. And when you look at this, again, quite stylistically quite different representation, and this is something that is inconceivable without the influence of Mughal painting, a sort of three-dimensional picture like this, with a certain level for, certainly for Basholi, a certain kind of naturalism. But interestingly enough, when you compare it now to the circa 1520 to 1530 Bhagavata Purana, so we're, centuries earlier here, some, almost 250 years, we can see the same placement of trees, the placement of cows to the right, a division of this composition into three registers. They're not as clearly defined, but you have the register of the river at the bottom. You have this central register of the cowherd boys frolicking by the Yamuna. You've got in exactly the same position Krishna pressing the feet of his brother Balarama. You have an upper register, which is compositionally different, save for the sort of anchoring device of the tree. But here you have a tree, here you have a tree sheltering them, so that again, certain compositional elements and certain devices persist in very altered styles. Now, in a general way, we can theorize about how such compositional devices were preserved, through family, the traditions of families of artists, and so on. But we don't know the specific ways that we can trace these connections from
maybe, Mathura, down into the Malva style, as with Nirja's manuscript, up in the hills to the Vasholi style. And these are just two examples. I could keep you here for a very long period of time. These are just two examples of many, and I'm beginning to look more. There's a 19th century South Indian Bhagavat in the Binney collection, which I'd always ignored in the past, but as I look at it now, I'm beginning to see connections even in this South Indian, this late South Indian manuscript in the Binney collection with the earlier Bhagavat. So we can't know specifically the mechanisms by which these transmissions occurred, just as we can't know specifically the transmission of compositional devices in earlier centuries, although we can generalize about it in a sort of general way. We can construct ways of transmission, but they certainly did occur. And I think when we look at this wide range of Bhagavad illustrations, we see there is a considerable persistence of vision over time and place. I've specifically, having the captive audience of Nirja and Andrew here, I've specifically left time for discussion. I'd be happy to entertain questions, to go back to any points or any images. And I thank you for your attention.